Imagine this. One huge historical event, a grand council meant to bring everyone together.
Right.
But instead, it causes this massive split, a schism right down the middle of Christianity that lasts, well, even today.
We're talking about the Council of Chalcedon, 451 AD.
Exactly. And we're zeroing in on one specific part, the infamous Session 8.
Yeah, this deep dive. It's kind of like a forensic autopsy of that session.
A forensic autopsy. I like that.
Our mission really is to uncover how things went wrong. We're looking for procedural issues, maybe doctrinal injustice, especially how Dioscorus of Alexandria was treated.
So what are we finding in this autopsy? What's the takeaway for you?
Well, two big things jump out. First, this council. Maybe less about pure theology and more, you know, politics.
Okay.
And second, the whole process, the way justice was handled, it seems fundamentally flawed. And that's key to understanding the split with the Oriental Orthodox churches.
And we're digging into actual records for this, right? Not just hearsay.
Oh, absolutely. We've been looking at detailed forensic analyses, the original council minutes, scholarly work. We're using these forensic flags to spot the, well, irregularities.
Okay, let's jump into Session 8 then. What's the first flag? What happens right away?
Well, right from the start, it feels like the outcome is sort of baked in.
Hmm?
There's bias.
How so?
The Roman legates, they're representing Pope Leo I. They arrive and basically say, look, we received directions that Dioscorus is not to be present.
Not even allowed in the room.
Essentially. They say, if now your holiness so commands, let him be expelled or else we leave. That's not really a discussion starter, is it? It's an ultimatum.
Wow, yeah. Kick him out or we walk.
And you have to connect that back to Pope Leo's view of the Second Council of Ephesus just 2 years earlier in 449.
Right. He called that the Latrocinium.
The robber synod. He basically branded it illegitimate and pinned all the blame squarely on Dioscorus.
So Dioscorus walks into Chalcedon already painted as the villain by Rome?
Pretty much. He's prejudged. A fair trial seems, well, unlikely from the outset, especially with Roman and imperial interests lining up against him.
Okay, so that's the procedural side. What about the actual theology, the doctrine? Dioscorus gets a chance to speak, right?
He does. During the reading of the Acts from Ephesus II, he makes this really crucial statement about Christ. He says, I receive from two natures, but I do not receive two natures.
Okay, unpack that for us. From two, but not two.
It sounds subtle, but it's important. It aligns with what's called Cyrillian miaphysitism, St. Cyril's view. It emphasizes Christ's single, unified nature after the incarnation, drawing from both divinity and humanity.
And that's different from the view they were condemning, Eutyches' view.
Right. Eutychianism was seen as like blurring the two natures together, almost dissolving the humanity. Dioscorus is making a distinction there. He's sticking to a respected Alexandrian tradition.
So did Chalcedon condemn him for that statement? Was he declared a heretic based on his Christology?
That's what's really interesting. The council itself didn't explicitly condemn his theology as heretical.
No.
No. He was formally deposed for, quote, non-canonical measures, basically. Procedural violations related to how he presided over Ephesus II.
So technicality is not heresy.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
And scholars point out that many bishops at Chalcedon held views quite close to Dioscorus's, drawing from figures like St. Athanasius. It raises a big question. If his core belief wasn't the issue, why the condemnation?
Politics again. Defiance of Rome. Challenging the emperor.
It certainly looks like his procedural actions and his perceived challenge to Roman and imperial authority were the main drivers. The condemnation feels primarily procedural and, well, political.
Okay, so if Dioscorus faced this intense scrutiny, supposedly for procedure, how did others fare, particularly those with, let's say, more theologically questionable pasts?
Ah, yes. This is where you see something that looks a lot like a double standard. Take Theodoret of Cyrus and Ibas of Edessa.
They were on the other side, theologically speaking, more Nestorian leaning.
Exactly. They tended to over-separate Christ's natures. Both had been deposed at Ephesus II, the council Dioscorus presided over.
What?
But at Chalcedon, they were rehabilitated.
Rehabilitated? How?
Theodoret's return was actually sponsored by Rome and the emperor. But here's the kicker.
Go on.
Both Theodoret's writings and Ibas's famous letter to Maris were later formally condemned as heretical by the next ecumenical council in 553 AD.
Wait, so Chalcedon brought back figures whose theology was later officially condemned?
Precisely. While Dioscorus, whose Cyrillian theology wasn't condemned at Chalcedon, was deposed for procedure.
That is a blatant double standard, isn't it? It really suggests political allegiance matter more than consistent theology.
It really does. And it ties into how Chalcedon treated Ephesus II overall. By branding it the robber synod and making Dioscorus the sole scapegoat, they created this convenient narrative.
A narrative that justified reversing Ephesus II and getting rid of Dioscorus?
Exactly. It kind of undermines the whole idea of a fair council process. It looks more like a political maneuver, a show trial almost.
And what about the emperor's role? Was doctrine being dictated from the top?
Oh, the imperial pressure is undeniable. Pope Leo actually preferred bishops just sign his theological statement, the tome, rather than even hold another council.
He didn't want debate.
Seemed like he wanted agreement. And Emperor Marcian and Empress Pulcheria, they actively pushed for Leo's tome to be accepted. It was treated like the official ruling.
So the final definition of faith at Chalcedon?
It was passed under constant imperial pressure. When bishops resisted or debated, the emperor himself intervened, demanding a definition acceptable by all, which, in context, really meant acceptable to Rome and the imperial court.
Theology subordinated to politics.
That's a core reason the Oriental Orthodox churches rejected Chalcedon. They saw the definition as imposed, not arrived at through genuine consensus. You know, the term Melkites.
Meaning kingsmen.
Right. It was used by opponents for those who accepted Chalcedon, highlighting this very perception that their theology was dictated by the emperor, not by pure doctrine or conciliar freedom.
So let's wrap this up, this deep dive into Session 8. What's the bottom line for you?
Well, for many, especially in the East, Session 8 wasn't seen as a legitimate spirit-led council. It felt politically rigged.
The condemnation of Dioscorus, the double standards with Theodoret and Ibis, the imperial arm twisting.
It all fundamentally undermined its credibility for the churches that became the Oriental Orthodox.
And the schism that followed wasn't just about, you know, fine points of theology.
Not entirely. It was deeply tangled up in the process. It raised the question, can powerful interests, political or ecclesiastical, just dictate what counts as truth?
Which leaves you with a pretty provocative thought to consider, doesn't it? How often, maybe even today, do we see history or deeply held beliefs shaped more by power plays and political maneuvering than by principle or objective truth? Something to think about.